emeritus professors are retired, so I don't know if you're telling me something, Bob.
I still have a day job.
So I was going to start today with a story, and I'm sitting down, and my kids walk in, and they see I'm preaching today, and so the first question they ask me is, Dad, is this going to be an interesting sermon or a boring sermon? And I say, well, it's probably going to be boring. And so they were really worried that it was going to be really boring. I said, you know, you need a good story to start off or have some jokes in there or something. I said, well, what? And so Clara tells me a story to tell you all. So we'll start with Clara's story. So two men walk into a bar, and right now I'm panicked. My 12-year-old is telling stories about going into bars, but... Two men walk into a bar, bartender says, what do you have? First man says, I'll have some H2O. Second man says, I'll have some H2O too. Second man dies. That's the high point of the sermon, Clara. Yeah. So the story I was really going to start with is in the Bible. It has nothing to do with two men in a bar. Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. We get this kind of curious story, and it's a story that I've long found fascinating. Years ago, I actually preached a sermon about the story, and it's actually, you know, it's kind of a nice story spreading throughout. So we'll start there, but Genesis chapter 11, verse 1. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And one of my favorite things in this is that verse, make bricks. In the Hebrew, it's actually, they bricked bricks. And I have no idea why I find that so amusing, but the idea of bricking bricks, that brick is a verb. So they bricked bricks and baked them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. And the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. And this story, you know, this is a classic in children's Sunday schools because it comes with this great image. And I remember as a kid, you get to make fun of these people that were going to build a tower all the way up to the heavens as if they could build it so high, and then we could laugh that they were just so silly. And then we learned about all the different languages. And it's really kind of a cute little story. But one of the curious things about it is, what's really going on here? And as you begin to look at this story a little bit, you begin to find this story, as we'll see in a few minutes, this linchpin in the entire book of Genesis. I mean, the whole book of Genesis pivots around this story in a kind of interesting way. And to see that, first we have to figure out, well, what's really happening here? And what's really happening here, actually, it looks nothing like all those little pictures you saw in Sunday school, this big, tall tower. This story actually begins in chapter 10. Buried in the middle of the genealogy. And the genealogies in Genesis are crucial to sort of putting together the whole story. We'll see this several times today. But in the middle of chapter 10, we get this. Verse 8. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. You get the picture about Nimrod here. He's kind of a mighty hunter here. The first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh and Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Calah, and Resen, which is between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Who's this Nimrod guy? Well, Nimrod, he's the son of Cush, right? Cush is the son of Ham. Ham was the bad one of Noah's son, right? So Ham gets cursed and so on. We know something about the Cushites. The Cushites settle in eastern Africa. And then we get Nimrod, Cush's son, who's going around founding all these cities. And where are all these cities? They're not in eastern Africa. Where are they? Well, they're up through Arabia into what's modern-day Iraq. What is Nimrod? Well, Nimrod, you know, you think he's a hunter. You're imagining out hunting deer in some pastoral setting. He's not hunting deer here in this story. He's hunting men. Nimrod is a great warrior, kind of leading, you can imagine, this marauding army through what we now call the Middle East, founding city after city after city, building an empire. And where is this empire centered? The first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, or Babel. Babylon, is the center of this great empire Nimrod is putting together. Now, you imagine you're putting together this big empire. Now, this is in the older days, right? If you have this big empire, and you've got a city here, and a city there, and a city there, and they're scattered through this whole region, what's going to happen over time? Well, there's not very good road systems connecting it. There's certainly no internet connecting it, no phone lines, nothing. So you need things that will sort of make everybody realize, you know, we've got this empire here. So they begin this process of building these giant cities, and the cities are going to be fortresses. And in these cities, they're building towers. And we actually know what these towers are. This isn't the only time we find about towers. These towers, there's archaeological evidence on towers like this throughout the region. They were called ziggurats. They were mammoth structures. And these mammoth structures, you know, this the sort of biggest one we think was what we would now think of as 30 stories high. So you imagine this huge brick temple-like thing that kind of look like pyramids, but they're leveled instead of just a sheer side. So if you're going up these levels and these giant ramps leading up to the top, and we think at the top there's probably some sort of temple, the sort of the stars you can imagine. And so when you see this, let's build a temple to the heavens, we know exactly what they're building. They're building one of these massive ziggurats there. And what's the point of them? Well, imagine you've got this city out in the plains. Well, in the plains, if you had a 30-foot high, or a 30-story high structure out there, you could see that from a long way away. This would give you a focal point for all the various cities, and they'd serve lots of purposes of sort of establishing, look, I mean, somebody really rich and important is here, but we've also got these big things to remind us when you're traveling through sort of the deserts, you can find these locations, and here they are in Babel, building this great empire. And as they build this great empire, they're saying, let us do this so that we may make a name for ourselves. They're going to build the biggest, richest, most powerful empire ever. And God looks down and says, are you kidding? No, you're not. And he destroys it. He disperses them throughout the land, and the empire ends. Well, that's kind of an odd little story. And part of the question is, what's it doing in here? I mean, why is this important? You think about all the rest of kind of the stories in Genesis. This in some ways reads like this bizarre standalone story just sort of sticking out, you know? We have Adam, we got Cain, Abel, Noah, and then all the stuff that Abraham saw. And then there's this one little story. There's nobody really famous in here. There's not like this big person that we're reading about. Nimrod's kind of buried in chapter 10, but he doesn't really show up in this own little story. So what is this doing here? And we get a clue to it because what comes right after this? Well, right after this is yet another genealogy, and so we get a long genealogy, but then the immediate story following it is the story of Abram, who later gets renamed Abraham. And you begin to realize when you're looking at this, you can split Genesis. You can split Genesis right at the break point between chapter 11 and chapter 12. Everything before chapter 11 are these broad stories, you know, sort of covering huge swaths of time. Starting in chapter 12, what do we get? We get the story of Abraham, which goes on and on, lots of details about Abraham. Then Isaac, lots of details about Isaac. Then Jacob, lots of details about Jacob. And then Jacob's kids. Suddenly the whole pace of the story slows down starting in chapter 12. Instead of this rush through history, suddenly we start spending a lot of time thinking about each individual in there. And the breakpoint is interesting in another way. If we look through the early parts of Genesis, we start with Adam. And then we get the generations after Adam. The 10th generation after Adam, 10 being one of these nice magic numbers, but we like number 10 for obvious reasons. So we have 10 generations. The 10th generation is Noah. Noah is also the first person born in the genealogical narrative after the death of Adam. So everybody coming before Noah is born while Adam is still alive, and I'll note here, it makes absolutely no differences for purposes of the construction of Genesis, whether all these years are literal or figurative. It makes no difference. We have Adam there. Adam dies, then Noah is born. And what's the significance of the story of Noah? God looks down, world is wicked, restart, wipes out everybody except Noah. Noah gets in the ark, kind of rescues humanity from complete destruction, and we restart with Noah. 10 generations after Noah, who is it? Abraham is born. It's a 10 generations before Noah, 10 generations after Noah to get to Abraham. And this break is really kind of interesting in another way, because we get Noah and the story up to Noah. And what is the story up to Noah? There's exactly one story in between the fall of man and Noah. There's also, interestingly, one story between Noah and Abraham. The one story between Noah and Abraham is this story of the Tower of Babel. The one story between the fall of man and Noah is the story of Cain and Abel. What happens in the story of Cain and Abel? Well, we know the part we talk about in Sunday school all the time, Cain kills Abel. And that's a great children's story because it means don't kill your brother, right? And that's a really important lesson when you have children, right? But after Cain kills Abel, something else really interesting happens. Cain then goes out, right? So he leaves the area where he is. He goes out. He wanders in chapter 4, verse 16. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city. Well, that's kind of curious. Cain was building a city, and he named it after his son, Enoch. So here we have Cain building a city. And then what happens? Well, we get a quick little genealogy. To Enoch was born Irad. Tirad was the father of Mahujael. Mahujael was the father of Methusael. Methusael was the father of Lamech. And then we find out something really interesting about Lamech. Lamech married two women, one named Ada and the other Zillah. Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain's sister was Naamah. Lamech said to his wife, "Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. What's the story of Lamech here? Now, Lamech is, it turns out, the 7th generation after Cain, another perfect number. So 7 generations after Cain, Lamech comes along, he's got a city, he's got 3 sons. And what are the 3 sons? They're the founders of all the sort of agricultural world, the artistic world, and the founder of the metallurgical world. They're building all the This is the founding of civilization right here in Lamech. And Lamech, 7th son after Cain, builds this city, announces, "I am the greatest ever." And then what happens? Flood, destruction of mankind. Now imagine you're reading Genesis for the first time and really paying attention. It's hard to imagine anybody actually noticing all this stuff the first time through, but imagine you're reading this story, fall of man, creation of this giant city from the descendants of Cain, this creating of a civilization, and suddenly find out everything's wicked. 10th generation out, God says, "I'm done, it's all destroyed." We start over with Noah. Noah comes along. What happens? We go forward in time. We get a story, creating of this big civilization, building of a city. We're building an empire for ourselves. 10th generation after, what's going to happen again? We all know what's going to happen again. I mean, this is just the pattern repeating itself. Man is pretty wicked here. You go forward in time, he gets worse, he keeps trying to create monuments to himself, he's destroyed. We go forward again, it's like he didn't even learn his lesson, starts creating monuments to himself, and then along comes Abram. But there's something curious about Abram. Abram, while he's the 10th generation after Noah, is not born after Noah dies. He's born before Noah dies, if you start lining it all up. And that's our first really interesting break here. I mean, what's the significance of this? Why isn't this a complete restart? And then you look at what happens when God calls Abram. Chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household," and immediately we know what's going to happen. Noah was told what? World is desolate, it's wicked, I'm going to destroy it. Leave everything, get in a big boat. And then we get Abram, comes along to Abram and says, "Leave everything, but not because I'm going to destroy the earth." With Noah, he says, "I'm going to destroy all the earth." With Abram, what does he say? Verse 2. "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." This is a radically different promise than the one made to Noah. He's coming to Abram and saying, "You know what? I'm going to make you into a great nation." And if you contrast the story of Babel and the story of Abram, what do you notice? In Babel, what are they doing? They are saying, "We will build for ourselves a great nation. We are going to build this mammoth city, and we will make ourselves great." And God's not objecting to the idea of the great nation or the greatness, because what is he doing in Shoel? He comes right along and says, "I will make you a great nation." The difference is all in who's building this. God destroys Babel because these are people trying to do this for themselves, creating this city of man. And God is coming along and saying, "No, it's not about what you all think you're going to do. It's about what I am going to do. I will make a great nation," he says to Abraham, or Abram at this point. But there's something curious here, too. What's not in chapter 12? And you'll notice what's not in chapter 12 when you look at it compared to Noah. When we meet Noah, the first thing we learn about Noah is Noah is a righteous man and walks with God. First thing we learn about Abram, well, nothing actually. We have no description of Abram and whether he's a righteous man, walking with God, who he is, why God is making him a great nation. There is nothing here. What we know is Abram immediately rushes out as the Lord had told him and does what he said. And so one possible explanation is Abram's actually this very righteous guy. God comes, says, do this, and he jumps and does it. But there's another possibility. You're sitting in your tent. You're ambitious. Voice comes out of nowhere saying, I will make you a great nation if you go do this. And what do you do? You say, well, I can hang around in my tent, or maybe I'll go do this. I mean, what is this voice again? Maybe he's just a really ambitious guy. So he goes and he does this, and then what happens when he moves out? What we have in chapter 14 is this great little story. Again, this is one of these that you don't tell in Sunday school because there's no obvious lesson for kids. But there's this great story of there are these five kings, small little fiefdoms you can imagine, and then there are these other four kings, and the four kings attack the five kings, and they rout the five kings, and they start hauling off everything. And one of the things they haul off is Abraham's nephew. So Abraham gets together 318 men. It's like a commando team. With his 318 men, he goes after the four armies, routs them, destroys them all, brings back everything. I mean, Abraham's doing what? He's making a great nation. We now know what's going to happen here. Abraham looks a lot like Nimrod suddenly. He's going to build a great nation, just like Nimrod built a great nation. We've got an interesting parallel here. How is this story going to pan out? I mean, this sort of seems a little odd. We know what happens to Nimrod's empire, but we've got this image going on. Chapter 15, God talks to Abram again. After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward. But Abram said, O sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus? And Abram said, you've given me no children, so a servant of my household will be my heir. He's sitting there, he's got this great commando army, he can go conquer everybody, he's got no kids, so what good does this great kingdom going to do Abram if he has no children to pass it on? He's just going to be handing it all to his servants. And the word of the Lord came to him and said, This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. He took him outside, and he said, look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them. Then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. Abram believed the Lord, and he credited to him his righteousness. And we get two interesting things here. The first is, this is the break point where we see Abram believing the Lord, and suddenly Abram is declared righteous, because he believed God. But the second thing is, when he tells Abram to go out and look at the stars, he doesn't say, so shall your subjects be. So shall the area of your land be. He says, so shall your offspring be. There's something different about this kingdom, God is saying. It's about his offspring. So Abram gets the message. Offspring are important. I've got a barren wife. If you want offspring and you have a barren wife, what do? You sleep with your wife's maid and have a kid. And he does that. And Ishmael comes along. Suddenly he's got his kid. Everything's going to be great now. He's going to have lots of offspring. And then God comes and talks to him again in chapter 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will confirm my covenant between me and you and will greatly increase your numbers. Abram fell face down and God said to him, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. This is some set of offspring. This isn't like you're just going to have a few kings here and so on. You're going to have many kings and many offspring. This is going to be a huge family. And then God says this, verse 15. God also said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of people will come from her. And Abraham fell face down and said the obvious thing. He laughed. And he said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? We all know the answer. You've got to be kidding, right? And Abraham said to God, if only Ishmael might live under your blessing. And God said, yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I've heard you. I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year." And suddenly we're watching the story of Abraham develop, and we're noticing something curious. Abraham is going to have a great nation, but it's not a great nation because he's going to go conquer lots of people. That seems irrelevant to the story. It's not even a great nation because he's going to just have lots and lots of kids, and he does have lots and lots of kids eventually, right? Those don't matter either. God here is creating a great nation out of a family, but a particular family. It's Abraham, and then not all of Abraham's kids, but Abraham and his one kid, Isaac. And that's it, not all the rest of the kids. And we're getting this lineage developing, Abraham to Isaac. And that's what makes the story in chapter 22 so shocking. As soon as we realize this, God's going to build a great nation from Abraham through Isaac. Chapter 22. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac." Now remember, Isaac isn't really his only son, but he is his only son in terms of this promise. "Take your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about." What the heck? I mean, imagine being Abraham. You had all these promises, you're 100 years old, your wife is 90, you had this promise you're going to have all these offspring and heirs, you've got one channel, it's only Isaac it's going to be through, and now you're supposed to go sacrifice this kid. And what would you do? Well, we don't know what you'd do. How many of you would sacrifice your kid, right? I mean, even on the worst days, you wouldn't sacrifice your kid, right? But you're imagining this, and what does Abraham do? He does exactly what God said to do. Takes him there, they go on the road trip, he's about to sacrifice him, the Lord intervenes. And in verse 15, last time God talks to Abraham, "The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, 'I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me.'" This is a mammoth kingdom he's now promising to Abraham. But there's something really odd about this kingdom. And you begin to realize, as you think about it, we watch the story of Genesis developing. We go from Abraham to Isaac. Isaac has two kids, but the covenant doesn't run through both of them. It becomes Abraham to Isaac to just Jacob. I mean, we've got this very curious family developing here. And then it's Jacob has his set of kids who become the 12 tribes of Israel. And so it sort of branches out after that. But throughout, we constantly see the references to the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. God is building a family here. And then as you watch the rest of the Old Testament, it is littered with genealogies, and they are the dullest things on earth to read. But why are they so important in the Old Testament narrative? Because contrast this kingdom with any other kingdom. If you read an account of the Roman Empire, what do we read about? We read, well, the Caesars came along and they conquered this area, and they conquered this area, and they conquered this area. And it's all this categorization of, here are all the lands they conquered, and you watch a map and you can see the sort of area of the Roman Empire expand, or the Assyrian Empire, or the Napoleonic Empire. It's all about territories expanding. But this kingdom has nothing to do with territories. What does it have to do with? Tracing the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's really important in this kingdom to document who's in the family, because the family is the kingdom, not the territory being conquered. When the Israelites roll in and conquer a new territory, these people do not become part of the kingdom of Israel. They are always the outsiders in the kingdom of Israel. The family is what matters. The conquering cities of Babel and the conquering family of Abraham are radically different. One is this city being founded by man that's going to go out and take over the world. The other is this family, a curious family, established by God. And then what happens? Well, this family image becomes really important in the New Testament. Galatians chapter 4. Paul is writing, and he's writing about this huge conflict that developed in the early church between Jews that were sort of recognized that Christ is the Messiah and Jews that do not recognize Christ as the Messiah. And this big split between, do we have to keep following the law just like we always have, or is the Messiah come and things are different now than they were before? And Paul writes out, and he says this in chapter 4, verse 21. "Tell me, you who want to be under the law, are you not aware of what the law says? For it is written that Abraham had two sons." We know about two sons, one by a slave woman, the other by a free woman. "His son by the slave woman was born in the ordinary way, but his son by the free woman was born as the result of a promise. These things may be taken figuratively, for the women represent two covenants. One covenant is from Mount Sinai," and we know instantly, if we're reading this for the first time, what this means. Mount Sinai is where Moses gets the Ten Commandments that's handed to this family. "One covenant is from Mount Sinai and bears children who are to be slaves. This is Hagar." That's kind of odd, because Hagar was the one that should have left the family coming through Sinai. And Paul's saying, no, the Mount Sinai family is Hagar. It's Ishmael's line. Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present city of Jerusalem because she is in slavery with her children. Verse 28, "Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. At that time, the son born in the ordinary way persecuted the son born by the power of the Spirit. It is the same now. But what does the scripture say? Get rid of the slave woman and her son, for the slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with the free woman's son. Therefore, brothers, we are not children of the slave woman, but of the free woman." And what is Paul saying here? He's saying, all of you who recognize Christ, who have faith in Christ, are what? You're children of a promise. Just like Isaac was a child of a promise. The church is Abraham's descendants. We have been watching through the Old Testament the sort of biological descendants of Abraham traced in minute detail through the Old Testament. And suddenly, along comes Christ, and Abraham's family includes the church. By being children of the promise, born by the power of the Spirit, we become descendants of Abraham, part of this great kingdom. And then the family imagery gets even bigger as we trace it. Christ on the cross, as the famous seven last words of Christ, and in each of these, he's trying to establish something really important. And one of them is he looks out and he sees John and he sees Mary, Jesus' mother. And he looks at Mary and says, "Behold your son." And he looks at John and says, "Behold your mother." That's kind of odd, because who is Mary's son? Jesus. And what is he saying? John's now Mary's son too. And if Mary's John's mother, that makes John and Jesus brothers. Is John in Jesus' family? And suddenly I begin to think, this is all through the New Testament. This image of being in the family of God, all the way through the end. Revelation chapter 21. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea." Then in Revelation 21, verse 6, "He," God said to me, "it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. He who overcomes will inherit all of this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son." Not subject, not slave, his son. We have, starting from the very earliest parts of Genesis all the way through Revelation, this contrast being set up between thinking about God's kingdom as this family that ultimately, God's in this family, church is in the family, Abraham's in this family. And this other way of we are going to build these empires for ourselves. The contrast is between this image of the city with the subjects and slaves and the image of the family with brothers and sisters. And what does this mean for us? Well, it turns out right now, this difference is really important for this church. We're sitting here as a church. We've got a new pastor who is starting 1 week from tomorrow. And we are faced with a really important decision as a church. There are two ways we can go forward here. One way we can go forward is we think about our church as, well, we're kind of like a city. And we're kind of like a city, and what does a city want to do? Cities want to be great. We want to be a great church. And we get a pastor coming in. What a pastor. Pastors are like mayors. And if we get to be big enough, it'll be like a governor. And if we can get one of the megachurches, maybe it's like a president or an emperor or something. And we bring in a pastor, and we look at this pastor, and we say, great, we now have this leader to help us make us a great church. And what do we expect the mayors to do? The mayors provide vision and they provide leadership. And if there's problems, you go to the mayor and you say, "Mayor, fix the problem." And mayors are up there and we hold them to this high standard. We say, "You better fix everything going on." And we expect them to solve all the problems out there. And if we don't like the mayor or the governor, we grumble about what a lousy leader we have. If we're lucky, we get to vote him out and we can go get a new and better mayor, a new and improved leader of a church. And we can think of ourselves like that. And it turns out that is the most serious temptation for every church out there, is to look at the pastor in this way, that somehow the pastor is like Nimrod, forming a great empire of churches. And we'll measure it how? We'll measure it by how large is our territory. We watch the expansion of the church, and we sort of say, well, are we influencing it? And we plant churches, and we sort of can imagine we're going to build a little Stony Brook empire in South Hadley, and we can do district by district walks to figure out what percent. We can do all of these things, and we can hold the pastor to that kind of a standard. Or we can say, you know what the church really is? It's a family. And if the church is a family, what's the pastor? Part of a family. And what do we know about families? Well, you all had one. Families are messy. Family members let you down all the time. Family members all have to do things. Some family members do the dishes, some mow the lawn, some seem to sit around and watch TV all day, every day, for reasons I can't understand. Why do my kids look guilty, right? And so we have all these different kind of family members, and you bring in a pastor, and what is a pastor? Just another part of the family. And if we think of a pastor as part of a family, what do we instantly realize? Well, it's our job to love this member of our family, no matter how unpleasant he is, or how pleasant he is. And we're all hoping he's a really nice family member instead of the annoying family member. But we all have a responsibility here to love and to care for. And we all hope that Dave and Sally come in and do amazing things in the family, just like we should all hope every one of us comes into this family and does amazing things in this family. And when other members of the family let us down, we all know, we all have been very gracious with one another's failings. We need to have that same graciousness with our pastor's failings. So when Dave fails, and he'll fail, of course he'll fail, we need to be gracious and say he's part of the family, and we're all a big family. And this was God's vision since Genesis, to think of the church as a giant family. It's hard to think of a church like that. It's really hard. And that's what makes this contrast, starting in Genesis, so important between all of our natural temptation, which is the city, the role of the city. We have our designated role and we have these other people out there, and this big, messy, ugly family. You look at sort of this early part of the family and you see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the sons of Jacob, and what do we notice? Genesis is brutal in describing them. They are really ugly people, doing lots of really ugly things, time after time after time, and yet God keeps blessing them because this is the family God put together. You look at the annals, the official records of Rome, oh my goodness, the emperors can do no wrong. And what's the difference? It's this entire difference between, are we building a human institution here, or are we building a family here? Let's pray. God, we thank you. We thank you for this church, God. We thank you for drawing all of us here and bringing us all together. And God, as we look forward, we ask, God, that you continue to bless this church, that you keep us faithful to you in all things, that, God, you spur us on to doing your work, but, God, never let us lose our focus on you, and that, God, ultimately, you are the founder of this church, and you are the leader of this church, and we all, as parts of this giant family, have roles to play. God, help us to play our roles, and help us to do great things in your name. In Christ's name, we pray. Amen.